Good morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. Today, Japan says no to a compromise deal that would have seen it resume commercial whaling in its coastal waters. And smokers, the number of cigarettes you smoke a day and the difficulties you might face in giving up your habit are largely driven by your chromosomes, which may have genetic variants determining your vulnerability.
If you begin to smoke, you smoke more if you have these variants. If you have this variant, it's more difficult for you to quit. But they do not have impact on whether you begin to smoke or not.
Your genes, your smokes and your chromosomes, a little later in the program. The world is about to become a tougher place for unscrupulous financial advisers. New laws will soon come into force which ban financial planners from receiving commissions on products they sell. The Corporations Act will also be amended so financial advisers are required by law to put their clients' interests first. The Financial Services Minister, Chris Bowen, says he's not attacking the financial services industry, he's just making it more professional. From Canberra, Samantha Hawley reports.
Labor backbencher Bernie Ripple headed a parliamentary inquiry into the financial products and services sector after the collapse of Storm Financial and Opus Prime. He delivered his report last year. Now comes the government's response.
Thousands of Australians had their life savings wiped out by inappropriate financial advice. They have a right to be angry and we have an obligation to act.
The Financial Services Minister, Chris Bowen, will announce the changes today, including a legislated ban on financial advisers receiving commissions. That's a much tougher measure than the Ripple report recommended.
By installing a legislative ban, we ensure that no operator in the future can get around conflicts of interest. And so it's important that we have a very clear set of rules. And those rules are that it is illegal for a financial provider to pay a commission to a financial advisor to recommend their product. Customers and clients, when they're seeing a financial planner, deserve to know that a financial planner is acting in their best interests. And when you have commissions, that is simply impossible.
Presumably that will have a big impact on the income of financial planners.
It will. A substantial proportion of financial planners' income comes from commissions, but they will adjust.
And when do you hope to bring in the legislation?
The legislation will take a significant amount of drafting. We'll endeavour to get the legislation through the Parliament this year, but of course there'll be an election later in the year. But certainly the 1st of July 2012 is the start date for the new regime.
The government will also give the Australian Securities and Investments Commission more power to act against unscrupulous operators, and it will amend the Corporations Act so financial advisers are legally required to put their clients' interests ahead of their own. Chris Bowen says he's also trying to expand the availability of low-cost financial advice so more Australians have access to it, but he won't say whether it will be tax deductible as recommended by the committee.
That be considered in light of the Henry Review. Of course, that's being released next Sunday. I've made it clear to the financial planning industry that it would be very expensive and therefore difficult to justify.
On the Henry Review, we're just under a week away from seeing that. We've had a guarantee from the Prime Minister that no state and territory will be worse off. Can you guarantee that no taxpayer will be worse off once this is out?
Well, Sam, the Henry Review's out next Sunday. There'll be a substantial government response next Sunday.
The Financial Services Minister, Chris Bowen, talking to Samantha Hawley. The opposition is against the changes, saying they'll disadvantage low-income earners. The Coalition's financial services spokesman, Luke Hartzka, told Alexandra Kirk the commissions paid to financial advisers on the products they sell allow low-income earners to access financial advice without having to pay an upfront fee.
What these changes may well do is preclude low-income earners from getting access to financial advice, advice to plan their future, to arrive at a better retirement, a more prosperous retirement. The loss of the ability to pay by commissions may have a detrimental effect on those who don't have the ability to pay upfront fees to financial advisers.
But aren't people going to financial advisers for objective financial advice, rather than financial advisers spruiking certain products and not others?
Look, people go to financial advisers for financial advice that is impartial, correct. But also, people have a range of situations. And many people may seek to purchase advice by paying up front, And that is certainly one way of doing it. But many people without the means to purchase financial advice up front may still need expert advice, and they may seek to pay for it via a commission stream. What the opposition is saying is that an individual shouldn't be precluded from paying for financial advice via a commission, and that should be a choice that an individual makes, and that commission should be fully disclosed.
The opposition's financial services spokesman, Luke Hartsicker, speaking to Alexandra Kirk. The government's decision to ban commissions is a victory for the industry super network, which has been campaigning for a crackdown on the way financial planners are paid. They say the overhaul, once passed by the Senate, will bring Australia's regulations on financial advice into line with the United States and Britain. The chief executive of the industry super network, David Whiteley, is speaking with our business editor, Peter Ryan.
Well, Peter, it's certainly good news for Australian consumers. We think that this means the end of sales commissions and kickbacks paid to financial planners out of workers' superannuation accounts. Over the past 4 years, over $6 billion has been paid in these commissions and kickbacks. This means that people can now retire with more money, and aggregate national savings will also increase as a result.
The initial recommendations from the Ripple Inquiry did not seek an outright ban on commissions. So are you surprised that the government is now proposing to do exactly that?
What the Ripple Inquiry did recommend was that financial planners should have a fiduciary obligation to act in the best interest of their clients. It's quite clear that commissions and other kickbacks paid by product providers to financial planners are utterly inconsistent with a fiduciary obligation or a requirement for financial planners to act in the client's best interest. So it was inevitable, once that recommendation was made by the Ripple Inquiry, that the government would take this step.
That's been one of your key arguments, that financial planners should, by law, act in the best interest of their clients, and you've won that. But how will that change the relationship between retail funds and their clients?
What this means is that people will no longer need to pay commissions paid out of their retail fund to financial planners. What it further means, and this is also a very important proposal, is that people will not be paying ongoing percentage-based fees for advice through their retail fund to a financial planner where they don't receive the advice. There's over 4 million people estimated to be paying for advice they don't receive and they don't need. This means that each of those 4 million people will be better off in the future.
And this goes to another one of your key arguments, that clients should be able to opt in rather than opt out from fee-based services. What difference could that potentially make to super returns?
Well, the research that ISN has undertaken in recent years shows that for every additional 1% paid in fees and commissions, consumers lose 1.5% in net returns. What that means is the more you pay to your super fund, the less you get in net returns. Now, quite clearly, that was an impossible situation to continue, and what will now occur is that people's net returns should improve.
The chief executive of the industry super network, David Whiteley, speaking to business editor Peter Ryan. Japan's fisheries minister says his country isn't interested in cutting its whaling program in the Antarctic in return for being allowed to resume commercial whaling in Japanese coastal waters. Under a compromise plan drawn up by the head of the International Whaling Commission, Japan would have reduced its catch in the Antarctic in exchange for being allowed to hunt up to 120 minke whales a year in its own waters. Not only has Japan turned down the deal, Australia and New Zealand oppose it, which means any possible agreement at the IWC meeting in Morocco in June looks highly unlikely. North Asia correspondent Mark Willacy reports from Tokyo.
IWC. It's supposed to be a rich cultural tradition, but whaling rarely gets any serious airplay in the Japanese media. If it does, like in this weekend story on the national broadcaster NHK, it's usually a cursory mention at the end of the bulletin, while in the papers it's normally buried in the back. But if the Japanese government gets its way at the June meeting of the International Whaling Commission, it'll have a stunning news story on its hands: the resumption of commercial whaling after more than two decades. Under a compromise plan put forward ahead of the meeting by the IWC's chairman, Japan would more than halve its annual quota of minke whales in the Antarctic from 935 to 400. It would then reduce its catch to 200 over the following 5 years. The payoff: Tokyo would be allowed to resume its commercial hunt for whales in Japanese waters, with its annual take of minke whales capped at 120.
This would mean Japan's four traditional whaling communities could return to hunting for the first time since 1988. Both Australia and New Zealand have slammed the proposal, with the Environment Minister Peter Garrett saying Australia remains opposed to both commercial whaling and Japan's so-called lethal scientific whaling. As for the Japanese, they too oppose the compromise, because it aims to cut their Antarctic catch. Japan greatly appreciates the proposal to allow us to resume coastal whaling, says the country's fisheries minister, Hirotaka Akamatsu. But Japan cannot accept a cut in its Antarctic whaling. It goes against what Japan has been asking for. It's too drastic, says the minister. So what is Japan asking for? Well, it wants both a resumption of commercial whaling and a continuation of the Antarctic hunt. And it plans to ratchet up the pressure to push up the proposed quotas as much as possible before the International Whaling Commission meeting. So this means that unless one side, Australia or Japan, caves in, then nothing is likely to come out of the Morocco talks. With an election in Australia this year and the Japanese government shackled to powerful pro-whaling interests and constituencies, the IWC compromise is likely to be the next thing facing the harpoon. This is Mark Willacy in Tokyo for AM.
Smokers, take note. The number of cigarettes you smoke a day and the difficulties you might face in giving up your habit are largely driven by your genetic makeup, according to new research being published today. Researchers believe several chromosomes have genetic variants that are linked to smoking vulnerability. Three similar papers based on studies of more than 140,000 people have been published online this morning in the journal Nature Genetics. One of the lead authors is Kari Stephenson, who heads up Decode, an Icelandic company which specialises in genetic chromosome data investigation. He's speaking with Ashley Hall.
These variants in the sequence that we have discovered do not have impact on whether you begin to smoke or not. But if you begin to smoke, you smoke more if you have these variants. If you have these variants, it's more difficult for you to quit. But they do not have impact on whether you begin to smoke or not.
So is there something that we can learn from this genetic variant that might help people to quit? Is there a way of perhaps developing a treatment down the track?
Of course, when you find variants in the sequence of certain genes that predispose to a disease, it always raises the possibility that you can use them as targets for drug development. So that certainly is a possibility. But first and foremost, it shows that even when it comes to things like addiction to nicotine, there is a contribution, significant contribution by genetics, and it tells us that the free will, the so much celebrated free will, may perhaps be a mixture of illusion and reality.
So perhaps people will use this as an excuse not to quit. They'll say that it's predetermined in my genes.
No, I, you know, so many things are predetermined in your genes, but it doesn't provide you with any excuse. It only provides you with an explanation. If you are genetically predisposed to smoking, you have more reasons not to begin to smoke. So rather than giving you excuses, it gives you a reason.
And that's because you're likely to be also predisposed to cancer.
Because if you're predisposed to smoking, you are predisposed to lung cancer, there's no question about it. We have proven that beyond reasonable doubt. So I insist that knowing that you are genetically predisposed to things like nicotine dependence, that it is not giving you any bloody excuse, it gives you a reason not to smoke. And I think that, you know, knowing that you have the genetic predisposition does not make the genetic predisposition. It is there to begin with, all right? And I think that you're always better knowing yourself in more detail than not.
The genetic researcher, Kari Stephenson, on a scratchy mobile telephone from Iceland, speaking to Ashley Hall. And you're listening to AM, where it's just gone 14 minutes past 8. The Queensland coroner plans to investigate the death of a 2-year-old girl who died earlier this month after receiving the flu vaccine. On Friday, Australia's Chief Medical Officer, Professor Jim Bishop, issued a nationwide ban on flu shots for children under 5. His announcement came after more than 20 children suffered severe side effects from the vaccine in Western Australia. Lindy Kerrin reports.
Over the last month, 23 children in Western Australia have been taken to hospital suffering fits, fevers and vomiting. They'd all had the influenza vaccine. Now it's emerged that a two-year-old girl died in Queensland the day after she and her twin sister had the flu shot. The country's chief medical officer, Jim Bishop, says investigations will continue to find out whether the vaccine was to blame. Professor Bishop says at this stage there have been no similar adverse reactions reported in the other states, but he says health authorities around the country have been put on alert.
We're looking through all the records. The TGA have not been notified with any particular signal from any other state, but the chief health officers and myself are going back through all the cases and seeing if we can see increased incidence.
The ban on flu shots for children under five will remain in place while investigations continue. Professor Bishop says he expects the test results on the vaccine later in the week.
We've got batches of all the vaccine that goes out across the country, so we can identify the batches that have gone to Western Australia. And the TGA will be undertaking their test this week.
The Australian Medical Association says an audit of New South Wales Emergency Department figures has shown no increase in presentations for children under five. But the National President, Dr. Andrew Pescher, says doctors around the country are closely monitoring the number of adverse reactions.
There will be some reactions to flu vaccine. We know that that is a statistical fact. The question is, are they at a level which in general protects the public and can give them the confidence that by far and away the public, including children, are better off vaccinated than not vaccinated? Because the flu itself can kill people, and each year in Australia 2,500 people do die from complications of flu. And in Western Australia, the rollout of the seasonal flu vaccine for young children was encouraged after a sequence of about four or five young children dying from complications of the flu a few years ago.
Dr. Pescher is concerned the latest developments may lead to an overall drop in immunisation rates. He says older people, pregnant women and children over five should continue getting the flu vaccine.
Lindy Kerin. After two bombs exploded on the Moscow Metro rail system on the 29th of March, people were surprised at how quickly the city appeared to recover and get on with life. But the blasts have had longer-lasting effects on one group of people living in the Russian capital. The bomb attacks, which killed 39 people, have seen a new wave of suspicion placed on millions of migrants who already suffer prejudice and fear. Moscow correspondent Norman Hermont reports.
Walking outside her drab apartment building on the outskirts of Moscow, Imani Zakayeva says life isn't getting any easier. She is a Chechen, something she's been reminded of every day since last month's bombings on the Moscow metro killed 39 people. It's tough for the local Chechens to live, tough for everyone. They are afraid the situation might get worse, she says. They are afraid they will be persecuted. Every day, she comes home fearing a backlash. Even though the suicide bombers blamed for the attack were from another North Caucasus republic, Dagestan, she says she and her children will do what they have always done, hide where they are from. I do not mention that immediately, not to scare people. I feel tense, and this tension will probably always be inside myself, she says. Groups that track the attitude of Russia's Slavic majority say it pays to be cautious. Alison Gill from Human Rights Watch says for millions of visible minorities here, prejudice is a fact of life.
Everything from sort of a generalized suspicion on the part of some people to a more systematic harassment by law enforcement authorities and in some cases physical violence from ultranationalist or right-wing groups.
Many Russians view the millions of migrants working here as second-class citizens. For proof, look no further than one of the country's most popular TV shows, Nasha Russia. Its star characters are two dim-witted Tajik migrants whose ineptitude drives their boss to distraction. It was enough to make the Tajik Migrants Association sue to try to knock the show off the air. Keramat Cheripov is the association's chairman. We can see how Tajiks come to Russia and become insecure, he says. We see the chaos and the slavery. and it's all showing. All of this in a nation that is home to the second largest number of migrant workers in the world. Some estimates are as high as 9 million. They are crucial to the Russian economy, but they are often not treated as welcome guests. It seems Russians are happy to have migrants do the jobs they won't do, but most are not willing to treat them as equals. This is Norman Hermont in Moscow reporting for AM.
With just 11 days to go before Britain's election, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Nick Clegg, is finally laying down the ground rules for a possible coalition government. Up until recently, the idea of either the Tories or Labour sharing power with a third party at Westminster would have been considered absurd, but it is shaping as a possibility. Europe correspondent Philip Williams reports from London.
With Nick Clegg's party now just a few points behind the Conservatives and a couple ahead of Labour in most polls, under the first-past-the-post system, he won't be Prime Minister, but he'll likely decide who will be. And that's because the race is now so tight, it seems no party can govern without the Liberal Democrat support. The big question was, what would be the criteria? The biggest number of seats or the largest number of votes? Because the way the Labour vote is clustered in urban seats, it's possible for that party to win the most seats, but not the most votes. Today, Nick Clegg finally made it clear. It's the votes, not the seats, that count.
It's just preposterous, right, the idea that if a party comes third in terms of the number of votes, it still has somehow the right to carry on squatting in number 10 and continue to lay claim to having the Prime Minister form the government. What I'm saying here is pointing at a very, very irrational possible outcome of mm-hmm. our potty electoral system, which is that a party that has spectacularly lost the election, because fewer and fewer people are voting for it than any other party, could nonetheless, according to constitutional tradition and convention, still lay claim to providing the Prime Minister.
And that's bad news for the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, because his Labour Party is trailing in the polls, meaning if they don't shift, he'll be jobless come May the 7th.
We're proposing at this election a referendum. A referendum on a new type of House of Commons, a new type of electoral system for it, a new type of House of Lords, a new kind of accountable system of electing members of the House of Lords without hereditary peers.
The Prime Minister's promise of a referendum to replace the first-past-the-post system with the Australian-style proportional representation has been seen by some as an attempt to curry favour with the Liberal Democrats, because they would prosper under our system, Nick Clegg could actually become Prime Minister. But on current polls, it's the Conservatives under David Cameron who will benefit the most from the Lib Dems' decision to go with the votes rather than the seats, although he's more determined than ever to win outright, something he emphasised at a rally calling for better schools.
Hung parliaments, hung councils, they don't get things done. You need people with the right values, the right ideas, to set people free, to give them their chance to set up a great school. This is a perfect example of why a decisive, authoritative result would be much better for our schools, much better for our country. And that's what we're fighting for every day between now and polling day.
11 days for things to go right and horribly wrong in one of the most unpredictable elections in modern British history. This is Philip Williams in London reporting for AM.
There are fresh claims today that the Environment Department ignored warnings that the federal government's home insulation scheme might lead to house fires and deaths. A whistleblower has told the Four Corners program that his superiors told him safety was less important than job creation. Before the insulation program was finally dumped 3 weeks ago, four young men had died and there had been more than 120 fires. Ashley Hall reports.
For Christine Fuller, responsibility for the death of her 25-year-old son Matthew rests in just one place.
Who do you hold responsible for Matt's death?
The government. The government for rolling out that insulation package with no plan. Just put it out there and see what happens, fix it on the go. That's what they did.
6 months ago, Matthew Fuller was electrocuted as he installed foil insulation in the roof of a house south of Brisbane. He'd been on the job for just 6 days and had received no training. After Matthew's death, his father Kevin Fuller turned to the internet for answers and discovered it was not an isolated case. Mr. Fuller found there'd been similar deaths linked to the installation of foil insulation in New Zealand in 2007.
I'm not a good web person, but trust me, in the government there must be some really good web people. They spent 6 months putting the program together, but they couldn't go on the web and find out that in 2007 five people were killed putting metal staples into foil insulation and being electrocuted.
In fact, a representative of the Insulation Council of Australia and New Zealand had raised the New Zealand deaths with senior bureaucrats from the Environment Department and the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet at a meeting in February last year, before the full rollout of the program on July the 1st. And a departmental insider has told Four Corners people within the Environment Department were also trying to warn their superiors about the risk of electrocution and fires. We've altered his voice to protect his anonymity.
In fact, we were told that safety was of less importance than job creation. That was mentioned on many occasions. We were told many times by senior management that the technical and safety issues were of less importance than getting this program up and running and creating jobs.
Did you advise your superiors that without proper training for installers, there could be deaths?
Yes.
The public servants even came up with solutions to the safety problems they'd identified, but those suggestions were also ignored.
Without a proper audit of the work, without a proper audit of the competence of the installers, there was no way of knowing whether a house had foil insulation or any material installed safely.
What's not yet clear is whether those warnings were passed on to the minister then responsible for the insulation program, Peter Garrett, or whether Mr. Garrett passed the concerns on to the Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd. Neither would speak to AM about the whistleblower's claims.
Ashley Hall reporting, and you can watch the full story on Four Corners tonight on ABC Television One. Melbourne Storm players are expected to be questioned about the salary cap scandal by the club's owner, News Limited chairman and chief executive John Hartigan. Storm stars Cameron Smith, Billy Slater and Greg Inglis have been named as three of the players receiving illegal payments disguised as third-party sponsorship deals. Last night, in a show of force, the Storm thrashed the New Zealand Warriors. Alison Caldwell reports.
Last night's match was billed as a massive test of Melbourne Storm's players, and commentators agree they passed it with flying colours. The game was over well before half-time. Captain Cameron Smith scored first for the Storm in what was an emphatic win over the New Zealand Warriors 40-6. Speaking after the game, an emotional and spent Cameron Smith said the players did it for each other.
To a man, I would say it's probably the proudest moment of all of our careers for an occasion that's built up so highly tonight. I don't think we've gone over a bigger hurdle than what we have.
He said at no time did the players ever consider pulling out of the match. Asked if players had given up on the possibility of appealing against the NRL's penalties, Smith had this to say.
Certainly not. I think we haven't spoken at length of that at all. It's been a very hard couple of days. But certainly I think in the next week that's something that we need to talk about. At the moment we're not pinning our hopes on being able to win premiership points this year. That would be ideal. We'd love to do that. But at the moment, it's about looking forward to each game and getting over the challenges each week.
There to watch the game was News Limited chairman John Hartigan. Tomorrow, he'll speak to players and staff and encourage anyone to come forward if they have any information regarding the salary cap scandal. It's understood forensic accountants investigating the scandal will examine the club's funding structure. In particular, a separate holding company owned by News Limited, which holds the licence to run the team in Melbourne. Valimanda Proprietary Limited controls the finances of the Melbourne Storm. Questions will be asked about what the directors of Valimanda might have known about the rorts at the club. In effect, it subcontracts the Melbourne Storm to run all aspects of the footballing franchise and in return pays a management fee of nearly $17 million. While that may interest forensic accountants, it doesn't mean anything to the fans, who turned out to support the club last night. Almost 24,000 people went to the match, double the number of people who would normally go to a game in Melbourne.
I think the NRL will get a strong message tonight just how
how important rugby league in Melbourne is.
Yeah, no, we'll be there every week until the end of the season.
Speaking after the game, Storm captain Cameron Smith was asked if the players will be able to maintain the rage.
That's a really hard question to answer. You know, I guess looking at it, this week would, if any time, it would probably be the easiest to get up for. We've got a really long year ahead of us.
Storm captain Cameron Smith, Alison Caldwell, the reporter there. To the financial markets now, and the dollar is buying 92.6 US cents. That's slightly down on Friday's close. It's buying just over 87 Japanese yen and 69.3 euro cents. West Texas Intermediate crude oil is up by $1.30 a barrel, and Tapis crude in Singapore, which affects our petrol prices, is relatively steady. I'm Tony Eastley. It's 8:30.